You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and this episode is all about that inner, about the inner critic. It's all about the inner, about your inner critic. It's all about your inner critic. Okay, you get it. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. I am pumped that one of my favorite plant party products on the planet is sponsoring this episode. If you've spent but a few secs skimming my Instagram or binge watching my YouTube channel, which you should, by the way, if you haven't, but when you do, you'll see that Sun Warrior Plant Protein Powder is the Kanye to my West, the Bees to my knees, the Wilson to my Castaway, something I would not want to live without. When I'm looking for a way to make my smoothies actually fill me up so I don't need a follow-up snack a few minutes after finishing my smoothie, I blend in Sun Warrior because I don't want to get bloated, gassy, or feel crappy after consuming protein powder. I use Sun Warrior. Because I am not a fan of protein powders with weird, chalky textures and nasty flavors, I use Sun Warrior. See, it's no wonder I blend Sun Warrior protein powder into every smoothie I make and bake it into almost every baked good I bake. If you want some recipes for doing the same, head to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/partyinmyplants. Click subscribe and you'll get an epic, easy Sun Warrior plant protein recipe in your inbox every month. And if you want to get your mitts on Sun Warrior for 15% less than the rest of the world pays to get their mitts on it, just use the code PARTYINMYPLANTS at checkout on their site, sunwarrior.com. Again, in case you sneezed as I said that, I said you can use code PARTYINMYPLANTS at checkout on sunwarrior.com to save 15%, my friend. The end. Of the sponsorship thing. I mean, let's get into the meat of the episode, or not meat, the tofu of the episode. Today's guest knows a thing or two or 52 about how to live a kick-ass life. She wrote a book called 52 Ways to Live a Kick-Ass Life, so that one was just way too easy. But just like you are what you eat, Andrea Owen definitely is what she writes about, which is a life kicker-asser and a not feeling like shitter. Her new book is called How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. Very literal titles. I'm into it. Andrea is a writer, a mentor, and a life coach who helps high-achieving ladies let go of control and choose courage and confidence instead of letting their inner critics call the shots. She's also a retired roller derby player who subtly hinted in this chat that she may come out of retirement. You heard it here first. And if you don't know much about what roller derby is, don't worry, I ask. This is a great episode for those of us who spend way too much time comparing ourselves to others, as well as for those of us who love crying to Natalie Imbruglia's song, Torn. Let's dive in. Andrea, thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
I have high expectations for our chat today. I mean, considering...
I'm pretty confident.
Yeah. Considering your website is yourkickasslife.com, this episode ought to be a kick-ass one. That wasn't pre-written or anything, was it? So right from the top, talk to me here. I'm not a big fan of broad questions, but I feel like it's only appropriate to ask you, what led you to that day years ago when you went to GoDaddy or wherever you go to buy URLs and pressed pay or whatever on yourkickasslife.com? Because that is a bold website name.
Right? Well, yeah, it's a really interesting story. So I originally started a blog back in 2008 that was under the – okay, so I don't know if anybody remembers when before WordPress was like the place to do your blog, Blogspot was mm-hmm. the place and you could get, you know, your free Blogspot website and start your blog. And I had one and it was at liveyouridealife.blogspot.com. And it was very life coachy and very cliche. And that worked for a couple of years. And then I was sitting down with one of my best friends who was also a brand new life coach. Both of us, you know, had just got our certifications. So this was in, I think, late 2009. And we're just having that conversation. Like, I don't really think that this fits me anymore. And what do you think? And we were messing around with names. And I had for several years at that point, you know, as I was going through my training and personal development was kind of coming out of my pores, I was very cheerleadery and said, life's too short for it to not kick ass. And so that's really how it was born. And I wanted it to be about them. So that's why it is actually your kick-ass life.
I love that. That's awesome. It's such an upbeat, you know, you can't not see your kick-ass life and be like, yay, rah-rah, like a cheerleader.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah. So I know that you have quite a backstory that led you to become a life coach. Do you mind sharing the spark notes of that? Because I don't know if people know your story.
Yeah, no, not at all. So what ended up happening is I learned about the life coaching industry back in 2003. So this is when it was very, very much in its infancy. Really, nobody knew what that was. And I found it on the internet and I thought, that is the neatest thing ever. I would love to be able to do this because I had really tossed around the idea of being a therapist and just didn't quite feel right. I didn't feel like my personality fit in well enough. And I was in the fitness industry.
Oh.
And so what ended up happening is I was sitting there, I never forget it. I was sitting at the computer telling my husband this, and he was my husband then, he's not my husband anymore. And I said, I feel like that would be a really cool job, but I think that in order to be a really great life coach, you would have to have some life experience. And at that time I was in my mid-20s and I just thought I didn't have enough life experience yet. So a couple of years later, that husband of mine, we were just discussing maybe trying to conceive our first child. We had been married for a couple of years and he had an affair with our neighbor and got her pregnant.
Oh.
And so at that point, we had been together for 13 years. Oh, I started dating when I was 17 and I was very close to his family because that's what happens a lot of times when you're with someone that long. And it sent a ripple through everything. It was horrible. He basically lied to his girlfriend too.
Oh.
And it was just awful for everyone. And it was dramatic and traumatic for me. And I did probably the worst thing I could have done is I started dating immediately. Hmm. I wanted a distraction. I did not know how to be with that kind of grief. And so I met a guy who I thought was Mr. Right. And I will give you, like you said, the spark notes. 10 months later, as I was holding a positive pregnancy test, I wrote about that in the opening paragraphs of the book, I found out that he had lied about having cancer to cover up an opioid addiction. So the whole time we were together, he told me he had cancer and he was sick a lot of the time. He was sick and then he would get better. And I didn't ever knew an addict before. I didn't know what it looked like. And I was in a depression from my divorce and I had isolated myself from a lot of my friends and but they knew I was dating someone with cancer. Like the whole story is crazy, Talia.
Wow.
Like memoir, it's so unbelievable. Like I tell
it
the whole story.
It does seem unbelievable.
So I had actually confronted him. I got suspicious about the drug addiction and started to pay better attention and confronted him about it. And he actually got better. He admitted it, got better, but I still thought he had cancer, right? Because I could not fathom. I don't know. Maybe
that someone would lie about cancer.
Who does that?
Oh my
God. And again,
God.
I had never been around addicts. Like I just didn't know that that kind of behavior existed. And so he agreed to get clean and he did it on his own. And he was well for several weeks. And that's when I got pregnant actually. Oh. And then he started using again. And then I said like, I can't do this anymore. P.S. I'm pregnant.
Oh.
So he went away to rehab. His family had an intervention. He went away to rehab. And I was actually considering like forgiving him and trying to. And at that point, I did find out that he had lied about having cancer. I was devastated and felt like an idiot. But I thought, you know what? I'm willing to give another shot because we're going to have this baby. Maybe he can get clean and sober. You never know, right?
Yeah.
I was willing to give him a second chance. And he met someone while he was in rehab. And I mean, that story is crazy because I was there like telling my story in front of these people and she was there.
Oh my
basically.
God.
It was so humiliating. And then he broke up with me. And so that I was like on the ground, I was like in the fetal position on the phone with my sister and I was hysterical. And I had just found out, you know, that he was cheating on me with her at this rehab. It was just like, it was like a Lifetime movie.
It sounds so done.
And my divorce still wasn't final, like from my husband. And I just was like, what happened? I was 31. All of my friends were like getting married and having babies and pregnant. And it just was like, it was just humiliating. And I decided I needed to change my life. And I didn't know what to do. I just knew that this was not my destiny. And that was my rock bottom. And that was really the beginning of everything. That was 11 years ago.
Well, it sounds like you got your life experience.
Right?
Oh my God. Nailed it.
Like, what? You call? Oh.
Oh my God. Wow. So it's amazing that, you know, instead of saying, this is my rock bottom, I'm going to stay at this rock bottom, as I feel like many people would do in that situation. I could just see you like lying on the floor with that song, like, nothing's right, I'm torn. You know,
Oh my God. Did you know that was like my song?
No.
I had like a spiritual like moment. So I'm from San Diego, and I lived there for 36 years before we moved not that long ago. And in Carlsbad, there's these cliffs that, and I used to run. I used to run and run and run up and down the coast. And I was on a run. So this was 2006. So that's when that song came out. And I stopped, I had my iPod, and that song came on. I was standing there on the cliffs, and I was just like crying. And you were watching me, weren't you?
Oh my God. I know. That's so crazy. I was thinking to myself as you were talking, I'm like, oh my God, I could see the soundtrack because you said Lifetime movie. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to say this. And I just decided to say it. And then that happened to be your song. Wow. Crazy. So that was your soundtrack to your Lifetime movie.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal.
I'm sorry. We're like making light of this. It sucks. But it sounds like it was honestly, I don't know if you could say this, but overall a positive thing, because look what you've done now. You're helping, well, it seems like you helped yourself first get a kick-ass life, and now you're helping all these other people.
Yeah, I had to. And really, like, I think it was such a pivotal moment for me because I had spent my entire life blaming everyone else for my unhappiness. And if everybody else would just get their shit together, then they would be happier. I would be happier. We would be happier. And I just was trying to direct my life. And I was just like a shell of a person. Like, I was happy on a surface level. But again, like, that was the moment where I realized, you know, maybe it's me. You know, of course, these guys did crappy things to me. I'm not saying that they didn't. And I'm not taking all the blame. But like, I was not okay. I was participating in some pretty crappy behaviors myself. So it was the first time I actually turned the mirror around and took responsibility for what I had been tolerating, because I had known something was up with both of them and ignored my intuition and my poor boundaries and some other things. So, I mean, I'll just start there. Like, because those are two huge things that I think so many people struggle with.
Okay, so you take responsibility, you turn the mirror around, and how do you get from that rock bottom to where you are now?
I started with my addictions. So at that time, I struggled with codependency and love addiction. So for anybody who doesn't know what that is, I'll start with codependency. Codependency is actually more common than you think. And I think we all kind of are on the spectrum. Of codependency, because it's a very fine line between healthy and unhealthy behavior. So typically people who struggle with codependency they really also struggle with control. They try to micromanage other people's lives. They get obsessed with changing other people and quote unquote helping other people. And they meddle in other people's businesses. They're always trying to control situations and engineer things to go their way. And that's a very, very rudimentary description. There's much better, you know, go to the Wikipedia page and read about it. And love addiction there's a lot of crossover with codependency and love addiction. And we tend to use relationships and falling in love and our partners as our higher power. We become obsessed with falling in love with the other person and feel like they are our savior. And we tend to get into relationships with other love addicts or people who have really strong boundaries, also known as love avoidance. So people and it's a cycle that we like to go through. And it's very dramatic. There's high highs, low lows, and we are like addicted to the chaos and the intensity of it.
Oy. So you identified yourself as having both of these issues, and then you just started to... Well, I mean, I guess once you become aware, that's definitely big step number one. And then what did you do to begin to heal them?
I started listening to my therapist instead of just like selectively hearing her. Mm-hmm. I kind of half joke that back then, like I liked I liked the idea of personal development. Like I had read a few books here and there and I liked it in theory. I would write the names of some of my friends in the margins of my self-help books because I was like, Talia does this and
is awesome. Does that,
or my, you know, my boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And again, I wasn't ready to actually do the work. And after all that happened, I have no other way of putting it except that I was desperate. I also was pregnant and I decided to keep the baby, and he's 10 now.
Oh, wow.
Downstairs. Hey. Wow. Yeah. So I knew that I was going to be a mom, and I needed to, I hate this term, but I'm going to use it. Like, I needed to get my shit together. I don't know how else to
say it. Why do you hate that term?
I just feel like it's so subjective. When people say that about themselves and they're beating themselves up, like, I need to get my shit together, I always want to know, what exactly does that mean? Because I think that when people say it, especially my audience, they are putting such incredibly high expectations on themselves that there's no way that they're going to do it. So I think that that's why I get all ruffled about that term. Side note.
No, I appreciate that. Well, talk to me about that idea of, you know, perfectionism, and when people say get their shit together, how that can actually be a bad thing. Like, how do you know if you are using it kind of incorrectly, if you are being a perfectionist about it?
Yeah, I think that we tend to want, well, I mean, and I wrote a whole chapter about this in my book. Just like, let's just talk about comparison. I think that we just do this as humans. I hate the advice of, like, just stop comparing yourself to others, you know, and then that's the key to your happiness.
No, like, that's not that? Doable.
I don't know anyone that does that. I always tell people, like, hey, just know when you're doing it. Like, the win, the massive win, is that you catch yourself in it and that you can pull yourself out of that trap very quickly, and that you can control triggers that you know are happening. You know, you selectively follow people on social media, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I think that we put these expectations on ourselves of, you know, I'm going to stop comparing myself to others. I'm going to eradicate my negative self-talk. I want to jump out of bed and feel happy every single day. And oh my God, like, that's not how my life looks. My life was a hell of a lot better than it was years ago, but we're just human. And so I want to, like, normalize humanness and just, like, let's all just try our best and be really aware of all of the shit that we do that makes us feel terrible, and work on that as best we can.
Well, your new book, How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, which is the best title for a book I've heard in a very long time, is all about saying goodbye, you know, to those destructive behaviors that block people from feeling happy. So I'm curious, you know, what are some of the most common self-destructive behaviors that you experience in women that you see are just blocking them from being happy, that they can, I guess you would say the first step would be to notice, and then maybe you have tools for, you know, improving.
Yeah. And it's so hard to narrow it down. Like, oh my gosh, I think if I had to, I would have to narrow it down to like 5 or 6. So probably the most common outward behavior, there's thought behaviors, and then there's, you know, the outward behaviors that we do. So those would probably be isolating and hiding out, numbing out, and self-sabotage is another one. And people pleasing is hard for people. And I think what else is super common for my people, it's control and overachieving.
Okay. Well, let's talk about them. Let's talk about feeling your feelings, because I mean, this is a silly question, but how do we know if we're numbing out, or if we're feeling our feelings, or if we're slightly feeling our feelings, or if we're putting off feeling our feelings? Like, what does it feel like to feel our feelings? And how do we know if we're doing it, quote unquote, properly?
I would venture to guess, and that is such a great question and kind of a hard and tricky one to answer, but I would venture to guess that most people listening probably numb their feelings out.
Really?
To some extent. Yeah. Like, we are a culture that loves to numb. We do it with alcohol. We do it with food. We do it with work. And we do it with social media and the internet. I think those are the biggest ones that happen for, you know, this generation, and even my generation. I'm 42. And I think that we tend to, and we do these things too, that are kind of like these noble, you know, noble ways to numb out, like work and planning. And sometimes it's tricky, because the things that comfort us, that we use to self-soothe, can be the things that we cross the line into completely numbing out. So, you know, think about any time you have some discomfort. Stress is a huge you know, trigger for people to start numbing out. Anytime there is something that's unknown, you know, some minor ones, like you look at your bank account and just feel stress about that. You see your friends online, they went on a vacation together and you didn't get an invitation. So that hurts. And, you know, what do you do? And then there's bigger ones like people dying and, mm-hmm. yeah. and, you know, getting fired and like the breakups and divorces and the really, really hard stuff. For me, when I got divorced, my numbing method of choice was dating. Hmm. I wanted lots of dates. I wanted men to pay attention to me. I wanted to fill up my time and energy with that because I could not bear to face the grief that I was in having my relationship fall apart and the rejection that I faced. I mean, I got left for another woman. My husband picked someone else instead of me, and she was younger than me, and she was beautiful. So like that kind of pain.
So are you.
I was, well, I mean, still, thank you. If it was so easy to just look in the mirror and be like, well, I'm still fly, you know?
I know. Well, so it sounds like numbing, another word for it is like distracting. It doesn't necessarily, because when I hear numbing, I'm like, I just picture somebody like in their fridge at like 2 a.m., just like eating cake and just being like, I'm not going to feel my feelings. Sometimes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it could also be like, I'm stressed. I'm going to put on The Office, or, you know, I just got divorced. I'm going to date like a crazy person. So it's kind of like, it's distracting as well.
Yes. And I think that what I see over and over again, the people that I work with is, you know, everybody has stress. We live in a stressed out culture. But what I always want to know is what's underneath that. Because typically there's fear and scarcity underneath that, afraid of not doing it all, afraid of failing in front of everybody. A lot of my people are afraid of success. Like deep down, you know, logically, they'll tell you like, yes, I want, you know, the multiple six-figure job. I want blah, 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 blah. And they can tell you that they're ready for it and they want it. But really unconsciously, they are afraid of it. They're afraid of what people will think. They're afraid of how they're going to sustain it. They're afraid of how, you know, will they leave people behind if they move up to another level, et cetera, et cetera. So I know I'm going like seven layers deep here, but there's always, well, I shouldn't say always, there's typically something underneath that surface layer of stress.
So what do you do? If someone listening, such as myself, just identified, as you were saying, ooh, I have a fear of success, which is a true thing that I actually know that I have before hearing it from you right now. But like, what do you do? So you identify, cool, I'm, you know, scared of that. And so what do I do now?
One tool that I love to use is journaling, is writing it out. And there's a few different ways to do it. And it is, you know, you can write a letter to your fear. You can talk about, so I've worked a lot on this because me too, same, like, and it's, for me, it comes down to like upper limit stuff. Every time something happens, you know, I'm up-leveling either my personal life or my professional life, that fear comes up. And I write letters to, I actually have it here next to me. I'm trying to think, oh, I just journal on it and wrote letters to myself. And I have a throwdown.
what do you mean?
With it. And I basically was like calling myself out on it and just basically saying, I'm all for self-compassion. And at that moment, what served me best was having a throwdown about it. And so I was basically saying, I'm tired of this story. I'm so tired of telling this story. I'm tired of hearing this story. I'm tired of complaining to my friends about this story. I'm sure they're tired of hearing it. What am I going to do differently? So I think there's so much power in putting pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, however you want to do it, just getting it out.
Yeah. And in that situation, I mean, I know you talk a lot about inner critics and, you know, the shitty self-talk cycle. How do you know in that situation or in most situations when your inner critic is the one speaking to you versus your, like, I don't know what you would call, like, your good self, your true self, your authentic self, your inner guide, your gut feeling, whatever. You know, how do you, when you're giving yourself that like throwdown, how do you know that's coming from a place of love rather than a place of like, you know, the inner critic stuff?
Typically your inner critic is really a voice that comes from your head. And I want to pause for a moment because not everyone hears an articulation or a dialogue in their head in terms of their inner critic. I wanted to say that because I don't, there might be people listening who are like, I don't actually hear that, but I sometimes feel like shit about myself.
Oh.
Sometimes it's just a feeling. It's just a feeling like you don't measure up, feeling okay. that you're not good enough, feeling that you will never get there. And so I don't actually hear a voice. So I just wanted to say that.
I appreciate that. I really yeah. appreciate that.
Depends on the person. And I think that to answer your question, it is still something that can tend to come from your head and be repetitive on a loop a lot of times.
Okay.
Also, your intuition is going to be sort of like this unexplainable whisper and voice. And I think that we are so disconnected from our bodies. And I mean, you probably agree with me in the work that you do.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I think meditation can really help. Not that I'm asking like, or saying, you know, you're going to hear the voice of your inner guidance through meditation. Not always. I don't, even when I ask questions sometimes, but I will hear it in some unexpected time. So it's just like training your brain to get quiet so that the voice will come in and talk to you. But really, that's a hard question to answer, because I think that what it comes from is just practice of really getting to know your inner critic, knowing what your triggers are. And that's what's helped me like, oh, massively, is I know what my triggers are.
What's like an example of a trigger?
So certain people, like I see certain people online.
Okay.
That, okay. So for instance, although I love her like tenfold, Gabrielle Bernstein and I share a literary agent.
Okay.
And every once in a while, I'll be talking to my agent and he'll mention her or something. And I'm like, she's farther along in her career. She has a very different life than I do. She doesn't have children. So she travels and her career looks different. I don't necessarily even want the career and the pace that she has, but it's a trigger for me again, because it's like my inner critic is like, oh, you know, you don't make as much money for, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Literary Agents than Gabby does. And also our book came out on the same day.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So where I'm like watching her like sell out packed arenas.
The detox one?
Yeah, exactly. Detox. And so I was on my book tour at the same time. So it's like things like that.
So what do you, like, you like feel something? You just feel like when you think of her in that situation, you just like feel like a sensation and you realize like this is a trigger for me?
Yeah. So it's like if I don't follow her on Instagram, but if someone like posts something and they're like, I'm at Gabby's event and there's like 1,000 people in the audience, and like my Portland event, there was 8 people.
Woo!
So it's like, of course I'm going to feel
right.
like crap in that moment of like, oh, yay, good for her. That's awesome for you.
So, okay.
Like,
no,
I know
I appreciate that.
That's a trigger for me. So, and I should mention, like, I choose not to follow her on social media. Again, I think she's a lovely human. I love her work. I recommend her books. But personally, I don't ever typically walk away feeling great about myself.
Okay.
So I think that, like, we need, I never feel great about my body when I look at a Victoria's Secret catalog. My body doesn't look like that anymore. And so I just, like, know your triggers. And when you know them, you know when your inner critic is speaking to you.
Do you find, I know you're a runner and a triathlete, which is incredible. Do you find that exercise helps play a role in like, you know, noticing the inner critic and also strengthening like your gut voice?
Yeah. You know, training can help a lot. And it's really interesting. Like there's been a few times where, you know, my battery would be dead on my phone or something like that. And I won't have any music or anything and just have to be with my thoughts.
Ah.
And know, right? And like hear my steps on the pavement. And those can be some really amazing times of just listening to the inner struggle and trying to get quiet. And some, you know, some days are good and some days aren't so good, but you know, so is life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So your book, How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, you know, you wrote it and I assume you wrote it because you experienced that a lot of people feel like shit. Would you say that?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the title came from, I would talk about these behaviors to my audience, like on my podcast or whatever, and I would name them and I would say, these are the things that we do because we think that they're protecting us from failure and criticism and judgment and shame. But, and they might work for a little while until they don't, because inevitably they make you feel like shit. And that's where the title came from. I don't necessarily think that people that struggle with these behaviors walk around constantly feeling like shit, but the women that come to do private work with me, they have everything going on the outside. They have tried to engineer their life to look a certain way. And these behaviors are just bringing them down. Wow. And they pretty much feel like shit.
Okay. So it's not like necessarily people are running around the world being like, oh man, I feel like shit. And it's more that like you have these, like, for lack of a better word, shitty tendencies and behaviors that are kind of preventing you from living your best life.
Exactly. You nailed it. And I could not have said it better myself. But no, yeah, it's really not for people who are, the people who are chronically walking around complaining about feeling like shit are typically not the people who are going to pick up my book and think that it relates to them. Because I'm guessing, because this is like how I used to be, they are still kind of blaming everybody else and like feel better complaining about it. They're just not ready yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's about taking ownership that you, you know, turning the mirror on yourself, like you said earlier.
Exactly. Yes.
So how would you say that social media plays into this whole concept of not feeling like shit about yourself? Because I feel like social media is probably the number one thing in this day and age that causes people to feel like shit about themselves, because, you know, we spend what, like 13 hours a day just comparing ourselves to other people, comparing our websites, comparing our bodies, comparing our food, comparing our homes, our travel, our lack of travel, like every single thing. So what do we do?
Yeah, I think that it's such a good question. It's so hard, right? Because we spend our lives on social media. And I think that there's really great things about it. It's connected us in ways that we could have never been connected before. And I think overall, it's a really great thing. But I think it has to get to a place of conscious consumption where you are, like I just said, aware of who you're following. And I love that now Facebook allows you to take a break from somebody for 30 days.
Oh,
because
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. So like maybe you can like unfollow somebody for 30 days and that way, I don't know, maybe they're going through something really amazing. So for instance, if someone is struggling with infertility and they just had a baby and it's like someone that you're friends with on Facebook and you just can't handle it, it's just too incredibly painful. And that would be a great time to use that. And
well, if they like made that feature, then clearly this is a serious problem.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I wrote about it in the book that I went through a phase where I had followed like all these fitness people who were making like videos on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that I was going to like, I don't know if I was going to like stop, drop and like do the exercises as I'm scrolling through Instagram, which if I'm sitting on my phone scrolling through Instagram, like I'm not in a place to like, oh yeah, I'm going to stop and do those like dirty dog leg lifts. Like, no.
Right.
The only thing I'm exercising is my thumb.
Exactly.
So I realized I was scrolling through it and I was comparing myself to these women whom I don't look like at all, and also making up stories about how their life must be. And just, you know, because we do that on social media. We post all these really beautiful pictures and that's what I was looking at all day long. And I know that, you know, people listening have probably heard this in so many different interviews and things, but you know, don't compare your life to somebody's highlight reel.
Yeah.
But we do it every single day.
Right. Yeah. So it's just conscious consumption.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is just, if I could just give somebody like one piece of advice from this talk, is be aware of what you're consuming.
Yeah, totally. And kind of in the opposite, what are your thoughts on the imposter complex? Because that's something else you talk about in your book, where I guess that's not feeling, well, you would put in your words what imposter complex is.
Yeah, it's really interesting that people don't, and this is especially common with women. It tends to be more common in women than men. Hmm. And it is a form of your inner critic, but it is more specific than that. So it's feeling like a fraud, feeling like you don't have enough experience or credentials or whatever, or like wondering when everybody is going to figure out that you don't know what you're doing. And also not owning your accomplishments, like chalking it up to good luck or great connections or a glitch in the system or something like that. And I see women do it all the time. Mm. It's the struggle. Yeah.
And what do you do? What are some solutions for that?
I think one of the things is getting comfortable with your successes.
Yeah.
And this is tricky. And I think especially for women, we are brought up to not do that, to not get too big for your britches, and nobody mm-hmm. likes a bragger, and be humble and be nice. And I am all for, like, you know, just fuck that. Like, can we not? I don't want my daughter to be like that. And I think that, like, one of the exercises I give in the book is to make a list of your successes. Mm-hmm. What are the things that you have done? And I do this exercise in groups, and always somebody is like, I don't have any. And I'm aww. Like, I don't care if you have mastered the art of a great French manicure. Like, what
that'd is, be is impressive. It?
You have to. That's hard. I don't know. How to do that. You have to.
I barely file my own nails.
Yeah. You have to spark it. And then once the process starts, and then it's interesting the language that some women use of, well, you know, I only did this, or I just graduated from high school, but I didn't go to college, and things like that. So I encourage them to change the language around that and say, like, I graduated from high school, and just start there, because it can be a tricky habit to break. And one of the ones that I think it's also helpful to look at where it came from, because it could have come from, I think for a lot of people, it comes from our culture. And for some people, it comes from their family of origin stuff. And those are some old core beliefs that you might have about yourself that can be best talked about in therapy. Or I think it's always important to go and try to figure that out with a trusted therapist. But yeah, imposter complex is way more common than most people realize.
Yeah. Even if you're not like an entrepreneur, just as if you're
totally.
Yeah, it's not just for entrepreneur people.
Yeah, the story, like, I think the opening story in there is from a woman who came to one of my retreats, and she shared a story that she's a nurse in the ER. And she said, I graduated with honors from nursing school, and I still feel like I'm the least competent nurse there.
What? Why? Like, what?
Why? Because the inner critic, because I mean, not to get like all feminist cheerleader on you, but like, we as women are brought up to feel fundamentally insecure.
Why? How?
On us feeling not good enough about ourselves.
Because of all the products being thrown at us. Like, you need to shrink your pores. You need to lose weight. It's bikini season.
You're not good enough. You're broken. Yeah. You're terrible. So I think that runs deep, whether it's your appearance or whether it's your job or whether it's in your relationships. You know, we hold on to these, and brain science shows us that neural pathways become created. So the thoughts race through and they repeat over and over again. That's why I talked about, like, your inner critic is on a loop. So the upside of that is that scientists also tell us that our brains they have plasticity. So we can change those neural pathways. A lot of this is talked about in positive psychology. So that's why I'm a huge advocate of working on your inner critic, so that you can hopefully change the neural pathways.
Is it possible to just, like, ignore your inner critic? So, like, I'll hear thoughts, or I don't know, I guess it's, I don't know if it's a thought, but I'll hear my inner critic say stupid things to me, and I'll just be like, I hear you, but I'm not going to, like, accept that, and I'm going to ignore it. And I still hear it, but I just sort of, like, shove it away. And I'm like, I'm not giving you power today. Is that okay? Or should I go that's the goal. Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I don't know if the goal is to just, like, make that inner critic, like, never say anything ever.
What I do is that I pick my battles with my inner critic. So I mostly do exactly what you did. My inner critic still chimes up and is like, you're never going to have a speaking career like, you know, so-and-so. And I have a mantra that I say, and I tell myself, well, that just happened. So I'm just acknowledging that my inner critic mm-hmm. is at play. And at the end of the day, like, our inner critics are an old lizard part of our brain that just wants to keep us safe. Don't rock the boat. Don't take risks. Don't start your own business, because you might end up failing, and then you have no money, and then you will die. Yeah. Like, it's these unconscious things that happen where it's just doing its job. That's why I don't believe that you should be a bully to your inner critic. It just doesn't work. There's a really great quote from two women that wrote a book called It's Not About Food. And I'm forgetting their names right now off the top of my head, but they said, be gentle. You're meeting parts of yourself that you've been at war with. Mm. So I love that quote around the inner critic. And no, I do the same thing that you do. So when I say I pick my battles with my inner critic, for instance, I don't know if I share this in the book or not, but there was a moment where my son was having a really hard time in first grade. And I was in the car at a red light, just like thinking about it and thinking like, I should be doing more for him. I should be advocating for him, like just spiraling of what a terrible parent I was and worst case scenario, like future tripping. Oh. And I stopped myself and I was like, no, not today. Mm-hmm. Not only not today, but I am doing the best that I can.
Yes.
So I don't have time to, every time I have a negative thought, turn it into something compassionate. And I do this for a living, you guys. Right.
No, that's awesome to hear you say.
A lot of effort.
Right.
But I just don't, like, we have, you know, what is it, 60,000 thoughts a day. I think that's just good time management, what you're doing. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's for me, it's about giving it power or not. Like, if I walk into the gym and I'm on my way to the gym and I'm feeling confident, I'm feeling fit, my gym pants are a little loose today, I'm feeling awesome. But then I get into the gym and I see this like super fit girl. It's my choice if I want to now beat myself up and be like, she has thinner, toner legs than you, or look, she's not wearing a shirt and look at her arms. Or if I just want to ignore that and not do that today. And I'm at a point where I'm just like, no, I'm not in the mood to do that today.
Yeah.
Like, amazing. Why do that?
Yeah. And I think, and for me, like motherhood is one of my really big triggers. And so that's where I choose to focus on self-compassion and really talk lovingly to myself, because that one can really send me down the spiral. But other ones, you know, like scrolling through Instagram and like being triggered by other authors and stuff like that, I'm like, nah, not today.
Yes.
And I move on.
Yes. We are on the same page. I love it.
Yeah.
Same from the song in the beginning of this chat to this. We are just in sync. Okay. So, but funny, you know, so we talked about the imposter complex. Now in your book, you also talk about kind of the opposite, which is the downside to overachieving. Talk to me about that. What's the downside to overachieving?
Oh my gosh. It's rough, because I work with a lot of very high achieving women. They have either climbed the corporate ladder, or, you know, kicking ass in a sales job, or they have started their own business, and they have a tendency to wrap up their self-worth in their accomplishments. So they have made their identity in achieving, you know, and I have struggled with that too. And I attribute that to graduating with honors from college and starting and having and sustaining a successful business. However, where it can go sideways is when we are doing it in hopes that we are engineering our life to look a certain way so that we can avoid criticism and judgment and failure and shame. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, where it becomes not being for us anymore. It's a means to try to protect ourselves from all of those things that I just mentioned.
Right. I feel like this is all, well, I don't know all, but a lot of this is about protecting ourselves from XYZ. Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote down to ask you about people pleasing, you know, because I'm proudly not a people pleaser, but I know many a people pleasers. And when I have friends that I see are trying to please other people before pleasing themselves, I just shake them, you know, verbally or sometimes physically. And I'll be like, dude, you live once. This is your life. Why put someone else's pleasure before your own? And again, I feel like even that goes down to the fear of, I guess, hurting someone, or the fear of that person being mad at you and having a person on the planet that doesn't like you. Or I don't know. Is that what people pleasing is all about?
Yeah, it's the fear of being rejected by either a person or group of people, a community. And that, again, goes into just us wanting that old lizard part of our brain that wants to belong. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's how we're wired biologically. But when it becomes, again, when it goes sideways, is when we are saying yes to things we don't want to say yes to, or it goes against our values, or it's just exhausting us and we have no time and energy for ourselves, and it starts to negatively affect our life. So people pleasers are, it's tough, because again, it goes also back to stereotypes for women, how we are supposed to be the nurturers and the people that take care of everything. And I think there's also a misconception that people, well, I should say women who say no are bitches. And I actually wrote a poem in part of the poem. In one of the verses, I talk about how, you know, we fist pump to seeing on Instagram, no is a complete sentence, but whoever really does that and doesn't get judged for it. And it can be one of those things that you work on that is just huge. And that starts with boundaries. And I think that boundaries are an art. And
I like that.
We have a lot of misconceptions about boundaries too, and how to actually facilitate them. And I have a step-by-step process in the book, because that's one of the number one questions I always get. How do I set boundaries?
What's like a first step?
The first step is to have the conversation. Well, the first step is to get really, really clear on what you deem as a successful conversation. Because I think so many times we think success is going to be if they comply with what we're asking, or if they don't get mad at us. If we can hug it out at the end, that's going to be successful if it goes our way. And the reality is like, shit, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to go well.
Yeah.
I can't guarantee that. When my clients come to me and they're like, I have to have this really hard conversation with my mom or my coworker or my boss or my husband or my partner, I don't know if it's going to go well. And the only thing that you can control is how you show up in that conversation.
Yeah.
Because you can still have the conversation with kindness and honesty.
Yes. I feel like as long as you're honest, that's all that anyone, like, no one can really, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like no one can really get mad at you if you're just honest and nice. I mean, I guess they can.
You'd be surprised.
But that's like their how much shit people choice.
Because you might be triggering somebody.
Right. But I guess maybe then what I'm saying is like, you can't feel that bad. I don't know. When I say no, I guess my biggest thing and what I like help friends with is like saying no to social obligations that they said yes to and now don't want to go to. And I feel like as long as you're honest, like I'm so sorry or blah, 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 like that's all you can really do.
Mm-hmm. And then if that person has a major problem with it, whatever that is, you know, it's their stuff, then it's their responsibility to talk to you about it in a kind way. So yeah, I think that anytime we try to set a boundary with someone, or even not if we're setting a boundary, if it's maybe just a hard conversation and that other person, and we know we have set it, you know, and we're proud of how we showed up and that person still gets mad, it's because they have been triggered. You have brought up something to them. So say for instance, like somebody comes over to your house and every time they come over and you have like get togethers and stuff, they get like completely shit faced drunk and you cannot have that because they're causing scenes or you worry about them driving home. And so you have a conversation with them and say, listen, I care about you so much. And I am so honored to be your friend and I'm grateful of our friendship. And when you come over, I cannot have you get drunk anymore because I worry about you and it's just disruptive. What do you think? And if that person gets upset with you, I mean, that's kind of an obvious example, right? Like you have triggered them. They probably are worried about their drinking or they're embarrassed or ashamed or whatever. So, but that's not on you. That's on them. And that's still really hard. I'm not going to say you need to just like, you need to just brush it off. Like,
absolutely.
No, that still will probably hurt your feelings if they get angry at you.
Yeah. Man,
life is hard.
Man, I don't, yeah, I know. I'm just sitting here. I'm like, wow, okay. Well, one thing that you do talk a lot about helping women with is feeling confident and courageous. So that's a positive thing. Let's talk about that for a sec. Why do you think, you know, people tend to totally lack confidence as a whole? And how do you help people turn that around?
I think that confidence is a byproduct of courage. And I think there's myths about confidence. I think that we think that we can fake it till we make it, that we can, or that some people are just born with it. Okay. I used to think that like once I turned 40, that I just would like, I don't know. I kept hearing like middle-aged women say that, like, oh, you just get to a certain age and you just don't care anymore. And I was like, I can't wait for that.
Just grow your confidence wings on your 40th birthday.
Totally. Like I was like the only thing I'm looking forward to about turning 40. Turns out that didn't happen.
You didn't wake up and you're like, I am confident.
No, oh my God, that's did not funny. Happen. So I'm a big believer that confidence comes from self-trust, and self-trust is tricky. I mean, that's a whole nother hour long conversation, but it comes from doing courageous acts, you know, like setting a boundary, like, you know, saying no and, listening to your intuition versus your inner critic and taking care of yourself, you know, whether you're, it's a plant-based diet or whatever it is, but you know, all the things I talk about in the book are not easy things.
Yeah.
It's doing the work. And when you get tired of the alternative, which is not having confidence and maybe feeling like shit, then you're ready to do the work.
I love that confidence comes from courageous acts.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really, I like really like that. In case you're curious.
Different.
What?
If there was a different way, I would have hacked into it. Trust me.
No, that's great. That's really great. So that said, if someone's listening and they're like, A, all over the place, like, holy shit, I'm a people pleaser. I have imposter complex, or I'm obsessed with overachieving, or I don't have confidence. What, like, oh my God, my inner critic, how do I ignore it? Like, you guys are saying you ignore it. Like, whew, what is like something somebody can do right now to like just stop feeling like shit, I guess?
Start with your inner critic and just write down what your biggest triggers are and what it says to you, and work on listening for that. And, you know, doing, I love your tool. I use the same one, is just hearing it and just saying like, oh, thanks for speaking up, but not today. Mm-hmm. And moving on. I think that's one small step that they can do that will help. And you got to keep at it.
Yes.
You cannot just do it for one day and be like, oh, my inner critic came back the next day. It's going to come back.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah. I've gone through like periods of going to the gym and feeling like a badass unicorn goddess person. And then like, I'm like, I'm over it. I'm great. I'm never going to compare myself to a woman at the gym again. I got over it. I've plowed through. And then I don't know, something will happen one day and I'm right back there. And I'm like, ah, you know, like it's not a permanent fix at all, at least for me. And it is a daily effort. And I think, you know, to your point, those are courageous acts that add up to confidence. I think when you can shove aside your stupid negative comments and just be like, not today, buddy, that makes you more confident.
Yep, I agree. Right? 100%.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that you agree because you're the expert on this. I'm just a noob. You're the expert. Okay. Amazing. Well, you also wrote a book called 52 Ways to a Kick-Ass Life. That was your first book. What's in just one way to a kick-ass life that you could tell us right now before I let you go?
gosh, I talk about several of the same things. One of my favorite chapters in there is just about having more fun.
Oh.
And I think that we don't do that enough, you know, now that we're grownups, and just, it's a really short chapter and it's just about trying to find things that you find fun. And maybe it's something you did as a kid and you haven't done for a long time, or something that you thought looked fun online, and, you know, go out and try it. We, I think, are fun deprived in this world.
I love that. Like, so you did, didn't you do like roller derby?
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about going back. So I haven't played in like 4 years.
So that is like competitive. What is that?
So derby is not, like, if anyone's ever seen video of derby from like the 70s, it is not your mama's roller derby. It's played with, do you want me to tell you like quickly how it's played?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm just curious.
Oh yeah, let me pull my sleeves up for this. So it's played with 10 people on the track, 5 from each team. And so there are 4 blockers on each team, and then 1 from each team. They're called a jammer. And so the jammers start in the back of the track and they score the points. And they are at the same time, well, every player is playing offense and defense at the same time. Oh. So the jammers, the whistle blows, and the jammers have to get through, that's called the pack of all the blockers. And the first person, the first jammer that gets through is called the lead jammer. And then they score points every time they lap the players.
So you score points just by skating around.
Skating around. And so they have to be very
fast or pucks.
They have to be very agile. So they're kind of like the running backs.
Oh my God.
And the, there's, you know, you can go on YouTube. There's like a couple of really great, very short videos that explain it better than I do, but it's incredible.
Oh,
it's fast and it's hard. And it's, you know, if you have a lot of anger like I do, then you it's a way to get it out.
And it's fun.
It's fun.
Like.
And it's the camaraderie. The culture is similar to CrossFit and just very close. And it's just, oh, it's amazing.
Oh, cool. Don't you have like names?
Yes. My derby name was Veronica Vane.
Why?
Because Veronica Vane just loves herself so much and gives like seriously zero fucks.
I love that.
My alter ego.
So cool.
I wouldn't want to be her all the time, but yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool. So follow the fun. Do something. Just do fun stuff.
Yeah.
I love that. All right. Well, speaking of fun stuff, here are my final plant questions for you. Are you ready?
Yes.
What is your favorite plant party restaurant? Just a restaurant where you like to eat plants.
Oh, where I like to eat plants. gosh, my favorite was actually in San Diego, and they had the best salads, and I don't even remember the name of it anymore because it's been so many years. I don't even know if I've found one that I love, except I love to make big ass salads at home.
Okay.
I have yet to, so my kitchen, wow. That's my answer, my kitchen.
Okay. What goes in your big ass salad?
Yeah. B-A-S.
B-A-S.
You've never heard that before?
No.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I love that. That's so funny. How have I never heard that? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's really sad. What's your typical BAS? What was today's BAS?
I usually do a combination of lettuce, like all different kinds of lettuce. And I love like strawberries and chicken and feta, just like with the balsamic vinaigrette and probably blueberries too.
Ooh,
and
fruity.
Walnuts or almonds. That's probably like my go-to because it's the easiest.
That sounds delightful. Fruity tooty.
Yummy. And I'll just put it straight out of the huge bowl.
I do that too. Just the big, ugly mixing bowl.
Why dirty another bowl, right?
Right? Why? Yeah. Mix it in there and then put it in a fancy bowl. No, thank you. What is your favorite plant to eat of all the plants?
Probably. Oh, it's such a hard choice. Probably a carrot.
Mm, just raw?
Raw.
Stick.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. I usually peel it though because it's, I don't like the gritty, like right out of the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little
you're not
bit
a
too.
Bunny.
That's a little too hardcore.
Yeah. Even though you do the roller derby,
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe Veronica likes it not peeled.
Yeah, just right with dirt still on it.
Yeah. Sounds like her personality. What is your most used kitchen tool?
Probably a spatula because I make eggs.
Yeah.
A decent amount. So spatula.
What is a book that has inspired you besides your own too in some awesome way?
I would say Don't Sweat the Small Stuff by the late Kenneth Carlson, because even though it was my first self-help book and I wasn't ready to actually put it into use in my life, it was the first time I read something that was like deeper than, you know, what I was normally used to reading and was like, oh, I like what he's saying. This is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, even just the title isn't like, that's like a mantra that I use all the time. I don't know if it's a mantra, but a thing, phrase that I think of on the reg, you know, when there's stupid, I'm planning a wedding right now and there's so much small stuff that you can sweat. And I'm just like at my fiance every day, don't sweat the small stuff. It doesn't matter. So
yeah. Oh man, that's a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So where can everyone go to get their kick-ass life on with you?
Probably either my website, yourkickasslife.com, or I like to hang out on Instagram. So same handle, Your Kickass Life. Come and say hi.
That's awesome. And your books.
Yeah, my books. Amazon, most Barnes & Noble. I'd be surprised if it wasn't at a Barnes & Noble, but all major bookstores and, of course, online.
I saw you're at the Union Square here in New York, Barnes & Noble.
I signed a bunch of those.
Oh,
so
cool.
I don't know if there's any left signed. Yeah.
That's awesome. So just like a little surprise signature.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, guys, if you live in New York, pop on it. Did you sign them anywhere else?
I signed them in Portland at Annie Bloom's Books and Chicago at Women and Children First. And where else? In San Diego at the Barnes & Noble and Mira Mesa.
Cool. Well, maybe someone listening will find a surprise signature.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. Well, thank you so much for kicking this podcast's ass today.
Thank you so much, Holly. It was so such a fun conversation.
It really was. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. If that chat didn't put some pep in your step, then I think something is wrong with your step, because that certainly had a lot of pep. Can you think of someone else who might love this episode? Then pep up their step by sharing it with them. And stop comparing your life or your body or your food to other people on Instagram or elsewhere, okay? Not worth it. Not worth it even for one hot sec. No, it is worth it. Listening to another episode of the Party My Plants podcast, I promise you there's another one that you will love if you scroll through the archives. Anywho, for a ton of takeaways from this chat, plus a heck of a lot more that takes the hell out of healthy living, head to partyinmyplants.com/79.